After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hello, everybody. This is Mind Rolling, and I'm Raghu Marcus with my pal, David Silver. David, how are you doing today?
I'm all right. Thank you very much for asking.
Well, and I like the fact that you told the truth. You didn't fudge it, because if you were really happy, you would have been way more exuberant, right?
Yes.
All right, maybe we shouldn't tell the truth. All right, never mind.
No. I think it's good because, you know, one of the things we're going to talk about today is that Mark Epstein article you found and about not pretending you're 100% all the time, because it causes tremendous tension and disappointment. And so sometimes when somebody says, "How are you doing?" you have to say, "I'm all right." You know,
most people, when they say,
"I'm wonderful."
Most people, when they say, "How are you?" They're not caring. They don't care how you are. It's just a pleasantry, right? How many people would say, "How are you?" And then if the person starts to say, "Well, Jesus, I got to tell you, you know, today was a terrible thing," you know, and they immediately recoil and wish they never asked that question.
Right.
So, okay, starting out here, with some recommendations. I want to hit the floor right away with some Amazon recommendations. Again, everybody, please continue on the Amazon trail. Get that thing bookmarked so whatever you buy through there, we get some support for Mind Rolling and MindPod Network. Trevor Hall has a new record out called Kala, K-A-L-A. And there's one song there that I was just telling David about because he hadn't heard it. It just came out last week. Something about the healing. I can't remember the whole title of the song. Obviously, I'm not that prepared. Sorry, Trevor. But it is got some beautiful songs. Really does, Dave. I encourage everybody else, check out Trevor Hall. And the album is called Kala. And let me go forward since I've got the floor here with recommendations. I got some fall book previews. And the one that I want to get is Chrissy Hine, Dave, has a book called Reckless, My Life as a Pretender. She chronicles her entire life from growing up in Ohio to hanging out in the 70s British punk scene, to the wild first few years of the Pretenders. Did you know her back in the British when she was there?
No, I didn't. I just was a fan, you know, loved her music. Really.
Live. I don't know if anybody, I mean, obviously she's a little older now, but she was phenomenal live. I mean, and she was just a really great example for just a heroic feminine figure. I mean, she took no shit from anybody. I mean, she was a really sexy woman. I mean, she is. She's amazing. So Chrissy Hine, My Life as a Pretender. And here, your friend here has a new, has a book coming out called M-Train, Patti Smith.
My friend?
Yeah. David's met Patty before.
I don't really know Patty.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good.
But I've been in her presence many times.
Yes, I understand. Overview. While Just Kids focused on one era of her life, this is her second book. This book jumps around in time from the death of her husband, Fred Sonic Smith, to a meeting of an Arctic Explorer Society in Berlin. That sounds pretty interesting. So those are two seminal figures in rock and roll, women.
Her first book was about her relationship with, what's happened to us? I've forgotten his name.
I know what's happened to us. Okay.
No, that, apart from that. Oh. No, I mean, the great photographer who was very, very, very controversial at the time, who was her best friend, and they lived together. We'll think of it. But, you know, he was the one that was really put down by the Republicans. Oh. Right wing said that he was a pervert.
Oh, because he was gay?
Not just gay, but some of the photographs he took and so on. But anyway, just to
Malaport, Malaport.
Robert, yeah. Oh, God, there are people out there going, I'm not listening to this anymore. we'll get it. But, you know, these things, I forget things when I haven't spoken about them for a long time, and I haven't really thought about him or her for a while. But anyway, the book was really superb. So if it's anything like the first book, it's going to be great.
Oh, there you go. And there's a book also from John Fogerty, a favorite son, fortunate son, is called My Life, My Music. I don't like him personally, so I'm just telling you, there may be people out there that like John. I never liked Creedence Clearwater at all. And so it's you shouldn't, if you haven't got something good to say, you shouldn't say anything at all. I'm thinking my mother right now. All right, Dave.
Well, just for those Creedence fans out there, I just love them. And still do.
Oh, okay.
He himself was
Thank
a controversial
God.
Character, you know. I mean, kind of an argumentative and difficult person, and sued. You know, he wasn't allowed to use much of his own music for a long time, and Creedence was not his, just in the same way that Roger Waters lost Pink Floyd and all of this, which is, to most people out there who are really trying to pay the rent, it has a ring of hideous sort of... self-absorption about it when rock stars who are worth hundreds of millions of dollars are really upset. I'm not sure John Fogerty ever was. I know Roger is.
Well, this said, when Fogerty's Creedence bandmates demanded to help write songs in the early 70s, it was the beginning of the end for the group. The worst thing that ever happened to my band was the Beatles, because the guys in my band thought that they could be the Beatles. These guys had no clue as to what was necessary, a vision. That's just the truth. That's a little bit about why I wasn't that fond of him. But he did write some great
things. He had to be the Beatles. I mean, what are people, nuts?
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like people compare the Beach Boys, who I love enormously. And I do recommend that movie so much to people. Love and Mercy.
Yeah, great.
It's a sensitive film. But people say, well, you know, they were as great as the Beatles, or they weren't as good. They are American Beatles. They were themselves. And you can't, you know, people's karma is exquisite. And, you know, people say, oh, well, when Bob Marley died, nobody was Bob Marley. Well, right. They were somebody else. And we're all given that gift of our individuality within the larger soul. Our roles are exquisite.
Yeah. And, what do you got, Dave?
Oh, well, nothing quite so inspired as yours. In mine are sort of...
Yeah, but mine are like $20, $25 books. Do you have something like a new refrigerator or something?
I do. But first, as a book, I really want to recommend a book to people because I love this book. It's called The Strange Life of Ivan Osokin. Hmm. The Strange Life of Ivan Osokin by Peter Uspensky. And I first read this book when I was a very young person, and it blew me away. And then I read it again about 5 or 6 years ago, and it blew me away again because I'd forgotten. Can't say anything about the book because the whole thing is based on a mystery that even one word about it could spoil, but I really recommend it. It's very, very inexpensive. It's a short book. And if you're on the Uspensky Road, check out In Search of the Miraculous also, which is a lovely book. But try and find The Strange Life of Ivan Osokin on Amazon. You'll like it. My big article... for money in terms of expenses that you've mentioned before, but I have one, and I realized I didn't. It's the UE boom wireless Bluetooth speaker, which is marvelous. I mean, I just can't say enough about it. It's about the size of a sort of a large beer can. You know those kind of beer cans that are a bit bigger than the smaller ones.
Yeah.
It's the size of that. The quality is, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. It's magic. You can't believe it. And it lasts a long time. It also turns itself off when you're not using it, so it doesn't waste its battery. And it's an Amazon feature, UE Boom. And
did I recommend that?
I think you did, Rago. And I at the time I didn't know what mine was called, but it's an absolutely amazing thing. And you use your iPhone if you want, and the iPhone doesn't even have to be in the same room to connect with this thing. And the bass and treble are both incredible. And for listening to everything from, you know, Hendrix to Krishna Das, it really is amazing. And, you know, seriously, I love it. Anyway, another thing too, I want to recommend something to eat. It's called Rawlicious Indian Spice Twisted Kale Chips.
Jesus.
Rawlicious. Yeah. Rawlicious. Indian Spice Twist Kale Chips. I'm a kale guy. Oh. And
really?
These are just fabulous, and you can get them on. You can just chew them, and it's a lot better than most of the things that people just snack on. This is a great thing, so I recommend them to you.
Maybe they could be a sponsor, Dave.
Yeah, Rawlicious.
Sure. Yeah, Rawlicious. Okay, we'll get in touch.
Right, right, right. So those are my.
All
I
right.
have other
wonderful.
Ones, but, you know, this is enough.
Yeah. Yes, and so thanks for continuing to support that whole thing through Amazon. That is well appreciated. And after we mentioned that, wouldn't it be great as another way to support the podcast or MPN, MindPod Network, wouldn't it be great if you just gave a small, and we're going to recommend today the number, $9, because it's 108 is the sacred number, so 9 is a particle of that. And $9. If people out there could say, okay, $9 a month, do a monthly thing, that would be fabulous. And many people have started to do it. So it's many, many, not many, 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 but some. But there is definitely a little bit of a wave, and that's going to help as well. We have introduced, by the way, we should mention to everybody on MindPod Network, we have just introduced a new podcaster, somebody who is very close to David and I, and been a friend for a long, long time. And we were in the music business with him, and he has started a podcast called Rock and Rolls, R-O-L-E-S, and it's Danny Goldberg. And Danny's got the first one out with Paul Krasner, who is an icon from over the decades, of someone who was an important person. He had a magazine called The Realist from the late 60s on. And it is fascinating and full of really amazing, amazing stories. And Danny really is pulling the best out of these people, and he's going to continue. And he has just a whole coterie of really interesting people. So check out Danny Goldberg on MindPod Network, Dave. Would you check him out?
Yeah, I mean, I've been talking to him for 44 years, so I've heard quite a bit of him.
You already heard it. Okay. Well,
no.
That's
not what I meant. No, it's just that, I'm familiar with his life. But, you always learn new things about people when they do it in a different form.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And we've talked to him a couple of times on mind rolling, and
Danny has the best take on David and I talk about the us and them stuff. We talk about the polarization in society that's going on in politics and otherwise, and he's got just a tremendously balanced take on that, which I'm sure is coming out in these podcasts as well. Dave, the other thing, we found this poem, everybody, and I said, Dave, you got to read this poem. It's by Tom Waits about Keith Richards, who Keith has a new album coming out too, by the way, everybody. And the first album in 23 years, new album, solo album from him. That's something else.
His two solo albums from 1993 were just incredible. you know, people tend to think he's just the guitar player in the Stones, and they always, you know, stereotype him as being an old drug addict. And well, he hasn't taken heroin for 31 years, which he made clear in his book. And, you know, he's very clear and lucid about his life. But anyway, we're looking forward to this new album, which is out in a couple of weeks, I think, or less. And Raghu pointed out in Rolling Stone there was a poem about him by Tom Waits, right?
Yeah.
And so what should we read it? I mean, or
yeah,
should
no,
we
read it. It's not that long. I think it's a fantastic poem.
It's a little long. So if you're there and you want to hear this poem, sit back. Or if you're driving, just keep your eyes on the road and listen. And you want me to read it?
What's the deal? You don't want to read it?
No, I'll read it. I'll read it. It's just I have to hold it and kind of not drop it. Okay, here it is. It's on a piece of paper that's a bit messed up. So I just want to make sure it doesn't drop. All right. It's called Keith Richards. He can run faster than a fax machine. His urine is blue. He smells like a campfire. He was once slapped by the Queen. He has walked the equivalent of 3 times around the earth. Like Keith, the Fengaris, Rebelly Catapult. What is that? I didn't remember. I'll read that again. Like Keith, the Fangaris Rebelly Caterpillar strums his bottom like a guitar, and the chord attracts the female.
Tom Waits.
At one concert in Java in the 70s, men screamed, women fainted, and a small boy broke his arm in the chaos. And it rained thousands of black worms the size of honeybees. He wrote his share of the songs from Sticky Fingers in a hen house in Malta. He once won the Hope Diamond in a poker game. And in the same night lost it in a game of craps. He owns a lug wrench and a tire jack made of solid gold. He was born in a cloakroom and has always been prone to fits of weeping, followed by hysterical laughter. One of his first jobs was cleaning out the lion cage at the London Zoo. Like the praying mantis, he has only one ear, and it is located between his legs. He can hold a note up to 6 minutes and has 7 or 8 notes more than the ordinary voice, and they are equally sonorous and clear. And then Tom Waits says, hands like a woodworker, arms like a swabby, a back like a soldier, a mind like a detective, shoulders like a boxer, a voice like a choir boy, and a country western face. His tunings are furiously guarded secrets. He claims one open tuning he utilizes was inspired while waiting for a train in Detroit. In a vacant lot, the remains of a barbed wire fence were half-circling the remains of an old foundry, and there, amidst tin cans, old mattresses, and dolls' heads, it occurred to Keith that a guitar is at its most rudimentary level wire that has been stretched across wood that, when strummed, produces a pleasant relationship between disparate components. Noticing the wire fence, in effect, contained these same ingredients, Keith took the lid of a discarded paint can and strummed the tightly stretched fence wires violently, rhythmically, and repeatedly. Disparate components, noticing the wire fence, in effect, contained these same ingredients. Keith took the lid of a discarded paint can and strummed it, strummed the tightly stretched fence wires violently, rhythmically, and repeatedly. I read that twice because I'm not smart. Thus satisfying his curiosity and releasing the peculiar voicings of the chord we now all know to be the chord at the beginning of Jumping Jack Flash. Transcribing the notes and adapting them for guitar, Keith lost none of the angular chord's mystifying and natural jaggedness, and thus the fence chord was born. Keith once took my $10,000 overcoat to put down across a mud puddle to allow an octogenarian, a laundress named Clementine Morehouse, to cross the street comfortably. That's Keith, always the gentleman. And Tom Waits, you know, would have read that infinitely better. But, you know, I think what he captured there was a real guitar hero, not just as a guitar player, but someone we all really, I don't know about people who are young now, but we just cherish him because he was that sound. He was the heart of the sound that was inherited from Chuck Berry. And he took that. And if you want to see something really great, check out the movie about Chuck Berry that Keith did. You'll find it. There's not that many movies about Chuck Berry. And when they have a fight in the middle of the film, because Chuck is a very an extremely aggravated human being who does not get along with everyone. And even with Keith Richards, who loves him and was playing backup for him, he had a fight. So as Keith Richards would say, this is how I'd say it. Well, just look at Rolling Stone. There's a poem in there, Tom Waits, and it's a bunch of fucking lies, but I like it. See you later.
Oh God, that's great. That's a great impersonation. Oh my God,
I only do about three impersonations.
Well, that one's really good. Oh my.
Yeah, I can I can do it like automatically.
Oh, really?
Hey, Rock, how are you doing, man? Where's that lost me marbles? Oh, this is somewhere where it is.
Keith Richards.
You go and do your impersonation. Anybody you want to do it with. I'm just going to take a nap now.
Keith Richards, the heart of rock and roll. That's all I got to say. Wow. I love that poem. Hopefully, you could, as David said, check out Rolling Stone. You'll find it, but it's fantastic. Okay, moving forward, I'm going to play a song, Dave.
Oh.
We haven't played a song in a while. I keep wanting to play a song. And this song is going to relate perfectly with what we're going to talk about coming up. Okay, so here I go. Here's the song. I'm not going to tell you what it is. Okay.
Anger, he smiles, towering in shiny metallic purple armor. Queen jealousy in him waits behind him. Her fiery green gown sneers at the grassy ground. Blue are the life-giving waters taken for granted. Quietly understand. Once happy turquoise armies lay opposite ready, but wonder why the fight is on. But they're all bold as love. They're all bold as love. They're all bold as love. Just ask the answer. Confident he flashes trophies of war and ribbons of euphoria. Orange is young, full of daring, but very unsteady for the first go round. My yellow in this case is not so mellow. In fact, I'm trying to say it's fighting like me. And all of these emotions of mine keep holding me from giving my life to a rainbow like you. But I'm a he knows everything. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I cut it off, Dave. The instrumental, because I got the point across.
Yeah.
Axis Bold as Love, Jimi Hendrix, everybody. one of the great albums you can go off to a desert island with. That would be one of the 10 you would take. And it's our thing coming up now is going to be around anger. And this was very much part of what this song was about, all the different, shall we say, disconcerting emotions that we all have to deal with. I love his line, my yellow in this case is not so mellow. That's so great. Anger. Okay, we're going to talk about anger. I got extremely angry this past week, Dave.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because an old friend from my India days created... whose name shall be nameless, created a situation with another friend that would be... my father used to call people like this shit disturbers, okay? He brought something up, which, first of all, was he had all his facts completely wrong, didn't have any idea of what the details of the history of the situation was, and he egged this person on to become completely berserk. And uptight, that's not a good word. Strike those two things. He egged this person on to become himself very angry, feeling as if I had misled them. And of course, then I reacted, feeling angry that I would even be accused of misleading. So it was a whole complex situation. And I ended up feeling really... it's been a while since I've been this angry at somebody for causing this this issue. So it started, you know, acting for me something to really think about, and think about the ways in which all of us get into this kind of situation very, very easily. And how do we deal with it? And what do we do about it? And I came across some stuff, Dave, that I wanted to share, because I've been sharing it with myself. And it basically, it came from an article that I had found from our Zen teacher friend, Norman Fisher, who we have quoted from in the past on all sorts of things. And he's applying five mind training slogans to anger and other strong emotions. Okay, so there's a couple of things in here that I thought would really help. It was helping me, and I thought it would help everybody else. And I think you can relate to the situation and perhaps identify it in your own life. But the first thing here is about nobody having the capacity to figure anybody out. Like, you know, but we do, right? In other words, I'm projecting what's in my friend's head about why he created this situation when I do not have all of the facts and all of the emotions that are going on in him. And the potential for mischaracterization is enormous. So we react. Oh, the train whistle. That is so great.
Very plaintive. Fits
wow,
in.
Wow, I love that. And we do this with people who are angry at. We know exactly who this person is, why or he is or she is unworthy of our regard and richly worthy of our anger. Why we should give this terrible person, why should we give him the benefit of the doubt? Never. Yet the truth is we have no idea what's going on inside this person. We have no idea what really makes him and her tick. We are angry at a phantom, a figment of our own imagination. Stop trying to figure other people out. So this is a good antidote here, because the truth is, in my own case, and I don't know, you could talk about yours, he may have had all of the exact... correct motivations, good motivations, heartfelt motivations, feeling inequity, that he wanted this other person to not have this. He could have had, and probably did, have all sorts of things. I went right to a characterization in my mind of someone who is nothing but a shit disturber, and is not worth contemplating anything else whatsoever. I mean, I think this is a great way to immediately look at something when you're angry at somebody else. I mean, is this not something? Have you? This is a pretty good antidote, no?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, Rog and I talked about this during the week. I mean, there's two ways. It's kind of bifurcated for me because, yes, you're obviously, you know, one has to be empathetic, sympathetic to the person that's angry just to see why, you know, and not to condemn the person and make a as them paradigm immediately. However, in this case, he definitely did something which, you know, one would prefer people to have restraint in causing trouble between two other people, all of whom know each other. Okay, his facts were wrong. And therefore, he'd never actually bothered to really find out the truth about the situation and spouted it out. So to say that, yeah, I sympathize with him and I'm not going to get angry with him because he's got his own way of looking, nah, that doesn't work for me. He's a shithead. Shouldn't have done it. Now, I'm saying he's a shithead. Does that mean I'm angry with him? I guess. Then, after having said that, one, as a human being rather than a saint, I then have to go to my teachers, my teachings, great teachers, Sharon and Pema Chodron and Jack and Ram Dass. And just, what would they think about this? And they would say, well, you know, chill, man, chill. You know, he did it. He, as Raghu said before, he thought he was right and he had a righteous sense about it. My problem with it was that the shitheadiness part of it is that he didn't do his homework and therefore created a shitstorm, I'm sorry to keep using this word, without having actually done the reporting, which is sort of like American journalism on the whole.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, I think your anger was justified, which takes us into it. But the question is, it doesn't help you or it doesn't help you to be angry. That's really, I think, part of it. And rage and stuff is never good, is it? So the question is, you establish, okay, he did a shithead thing. Now I've got to think about why he did it and not perhaps try and be sufficiently compassionate that I will not revenge on him and will not allow it to perpetuate in my consciousness too long. It's about the best I can hope for.
I guess the thing that I this brought up for me, this particular don't try to figure other people out, is the fact that I do know that many's a time I am projecting onto the person that I'm angry at so much stuff. It could be stuff that I'm not happy about with myself, and it could be just other fantasies about this person I'm projecting to make it even more dramatic and give me more cause to be angry at that person. That's what I took away from this, that both the projection and also the fact, again, that I easily can be angry at myself, perhaps. I might have done something like this. I might have manipulated something in my past. And so I think, you know, sometimes we can look at that and look at ourselves in that way.
You're absolutely right. But in this particular case, I think you're too hard on yourself. In other words, you often say that you have an anger component, and I know what you're talking about, but I think you're one of the more empathetic people I've ever met in my life. And maybe your anger is not about something you would have done, but is just about, you know, saying, how could this person do this? In other words, I'm throwing it out as a dialectic here, and it's going to lead to our next anger article, which is very interesting also, which is it bad to be angry? Always. Is it always bad to be angry? In other words, the people right now, I mean, I must say that when I look at Facebook, the ones that are really angry, even if they're angry about the same thing that I'm angry about, I'm turned off. Always. You know, they say, well, you know, Trump is an asshole. Trump is a pig. Trump is an idiot. Trump is a liar. Trump is a force of evil. Maybe those things are true, but do I really want to see that? Do I continually want to be immersed in the murky, you know, water of anger and drown what eventually is going to happen to a permanently angry person. They're going to get sick.
Yeah.
So, but I just want to say to the people out there that I think Rog has been very, very honest about this, about trying to, you know, to transcend this anger. But I think there are some cases when anger is appropriate as long as it doesn't turn into revenge, rage, and can then be calibrated to act either in talking with that person or at least trying to see what's going on. Why did he do this? And that's good. Something I find very hard to do also.
Another way when we're angry, we typically blame. Right, blame our old. We've talked about blame before and lash out. Most of us, how about this? Most of us are not courageous enough to lash out at the people we're actually angry at. So instead, we lash out at someone else who's safer and nearer to us. Right? We take pot shots. We gossip or just grouse and feel indignant in the privacy of our own minds. These activities probably don't hurt the target of our anger at all. They do hurt us and other people plenty. So. That how often does that happen when you're, you know, you get angry at something and you come home from work and, you know, your kids are around, your wife is around, your husband is around, your mother is around, your father, and that's who you lash out at. How often does that happen, right? I mean, a lot. So that is absolutely something to take a look at, you know, blaming and lashing out of that emotion. For sure. The truth is anger is very hard to overcome, and the job of seeing through it takes a lot longer than you think. Even when you believe you are finally finished with anger, oh boy, do I know that. Subsequent events will prove that you're not. Hope that it's gone or going to get over with soon can breed laziness and even impatience. Yet patience, which requires an act of courage, is what you need the most. So internally, you really do need to have the commitment to go on working with your anger. That is highly, highly important. And that brings in, of course, mindfulness. That brings in, of course, patience. That brings in a commitment to wanting to be just a better human being. So think that that's important. And here's something else. Don't poison yourself. Poison in this case means self-centeredness, right? Self-cherishing, self-centeredness. Each of us does have to be responsible for ourselves and not expect others to take care of us. But at the same time, it's clear that excessive self-concern is counterproductive. It leads to paranoia, greed, and negative personal and social consequence. The antidote to this poison is a wise concern for others that will balance self-concern. Wise concern for others absolutely balances so much of our lives and gives, to me, real meaning when we can start thinking about other people and not just ourselves. So that's, I think, a really... important point as well. When we become defensive and aggressive, it's usually because of the poison of self-concern. So that's another one. And last in our little antidotes for anger, let's say when we get angry, we clam up, we observe ourselves doing this and we investigate. Is this just an old habit that we have in fact outgrown? Where does it come from? Do we like it or dislike it? Right there and then. I mean, I think we've talked, Dave and I, about this before. And I have said, I notice when I get angry and I'm going off about something, how, first of all, a lot of other things that I'm unhappy with come into that moment. And then there's a power. Anger has a power. And people get attached to that power. It actually feels good. And you, so again, mindfulness and awareness, you can actually discern the taste of what that anger is to you. And liking it, disliking it, do we find comfort in it? How does it feel in the body? Is something else possible in this moment? Could we be a little more creative, a little less lazy in the way we respond, right? I mean, because you get into this, you kind of feel like, oh, it feels good, you know, that power. And then the next thing you know, you're not even thinking about being able to cut it off. You're enjoying it. I mean, it's really kind of sick, actually. That's what I find.
It is.
Yeah. Insofar as anger always presents us forcefully with the possibility that we could challenge our usual way of doing business. That's the key. We can challenge our usual way of doing business. It can be a very helpful reminder of who we are now and who we might become. Anger is an acupressure point in the heart. Norman Fisher. Love that. That's just fantastic. It might feel sore and raw when it's bumped, but that's good. If we know how to be patient with the pain, how to gently and skillfully massage it, it can be healed by anger itself. How about that for a segue into what's wrong with being angry? Dave, yes. You take it.
Oh, okay. Well, Raghu sent some, or suggested I read an article by Mark Epstein, who's a therapist and a Buddhist, and you know, he is writing about, well, you get angry, and he writes about these anecdotes about, you know, cooking something with his wife, some salad or something, and his wife wasn't doing it the way he wanted to do it, and they're very much in love and they're a great couple. And within a very short time, the thing escalated into anger, rage, recrimination, and so forth. Then he tells another anecdote about a couple he knows who also love each other, who are in Paris and had an argument about nothing on the streets of Paris. The guy threw all his money on the ground in rage, ran away, and then went back to New York, left his wife in Paris, who then, you know, stayed there for a few days and felt terrible. But what Mark Epstein is saying, which I think is really important, and I do think this, is that you can't force yourself to do something which is actually inhuman. In other words, you have an argument. And he's saying, well, you have an argument, but that doesn't necessarily mean you hate the person. And within a very short time, you can actually teach yourself and discipline yourself to know that the argument's okay and even the anger's okay as long as you can come around the corner with it and say, I was angry, but I love you, baby. I love you. And I'm just going to, you know, and we've all, those of us that have been married, have all had these experiences. And we've also all had the wonderful experience of non-attachment to it, whereby either you or your spouse or your partner, you know, says, oh, honey, you're so angry. Don't get angry. I mean, all right, I'm wrong, or just we agree to disagree, which is sort of almost like a television talk show, political talk show thing to say. So it's not the kind of, oh, darling, we agree to disagree. It never comes out like that. Eventually, what happens is I'm sorry, but the thing is repression of that anger at an event always got to be 100%. And what Epstein, Dr. Epstein says, and I think rather wisely, is no, you can get angry, and then you don't recriminate yourself or the other person for very long, and you don't try and attune the other person to your point of view or vice versa, because, and he talks about parenting, about kids drive you crazy sometimes, and those of us who have had children know this is true. And for a moment, and this is not going to please everyone, what I'm about to say, you hate your kid. You want to strangulate her or him. It's true. It comes up. It's there. Is it real? Well, is anything real? It is as real as anything else is. And what happens is you overcome that. But you don't say, I wasn't really angry. You don't say, oh, she's perfect and I'm just an asshole. It doesn't, that just doesn't help. And Epstein, with great, you know, wisdom, says that there was a thing, Raghu, he talks about it in here, about parenting, called, you know, you can't be a perfect mother. D.W. Winnicott, who was a British analyst, said, you know, you've got to be a good enough mother or a good enough father. And he's not saying you compromise and don't be, you know, do the best you can be. He's just saying, you know, you can't be 100% with your kids because sometimes they drive you crazy and vice versa. They can't always be totally, oh, I love my mummy even though she's absolutely driving me crazy. So there's an honesty factor here. I don't know whether I've articulated this too well, but basically he's saying what's wrong with being angry and then transcending that and returning to the love, the reason you're in that room with that person, that family. You know, the mysterious, mystical fact is that you are with these people and not with other people. So, yeah. Given that, unless it becomes ridiculous and then there's divorce and whatever, but in most cases you can overcome it, but by not pretending that you're not angry and just looking at it almost from a distance, like, oh, look, I'm angry. Look at that. I'm angry. I really am angry with my little kid. But then letting it go, as all the mindfulness teachers say, is just, you know, let it fade away slowly into the distance and see your anger and maybe try to be a little more equanimous the next time.
Yeah. This is actually what you just said is, and he ties it together, and you just talked about mindfulness here. There's a great way in which this ties together, and certainly he talks here about returning after disruption to an appreciation of the connection, right? And to me, the key word is return, and this is something else we've talked about, and I like what he says here. It's considered a sign, we're talking about, so he's comparing this to meditation. Disruption, failure, and disagreement are healthy and normal. Right? We are human. Learning to transition between connection and separateness without losing faith is a great challenge, that for sure. In meditation, which has been essential, he's talking about how it's helped in accepting the entire range of his emotional responses, bringing the mind back to the central object, the breath, a prayer, or a visualization when I get distracted. It's considered a sign of maturity in meditation when the distractions are no longer viewed as problems, but can instead become objects of meditative interest in themselves.
Mm.
Right? And this is again, goes back to what Sharon Salzberg talks a lot about, is you, as soon as you remember that your mind, you know, you've been thinking about all sorts of stuff for 5 minutes and have lost your focus on your central focus, one point of one-pointedness, you return to that place. And that's why practice is so important. This is a key thing here, because we're talking, you know, he's talking, of course, about relationships and getting angry and fighting and so on. And if you realize we are human, these disruptions happen, you return to what's kept you, what's how you connected, or you return when you lose focus to the one point that you have been focusing on. The more that you practice that, I would have to say that you'll have a much better chance of being able to go through these disruptions in a way more facile method.
There's no arguing with that. You know, it's just, I mean, I've definitely improved a little bit than when I was a younger human about politics and anger. Mm. You know, because I used to just get irate beyond words at right-wing cold-heartedness and so forth. And over the years, I've learned to be angry at what they're espousing, but not to ad hominem or ad womanem, you know, hate them. Because it's not a question of whether they deserve your hatred. It's really a question of your own, you know, balance, that you're going to lose your balance if you continue to be angry. I still think that I'm angry about politics. And I recently had an experience with someone I really like. I've liked him for 20 years. I admire him, respect him, love him to death. And it has emerged over the last couple of years that he's an extreme right winger. He sort of kept it hidden from me for a long time.
Oh, really?
And we talked about it last week. We actually talked about this together, about how we don't get angry with each other, even though we have opposing views.
I know who it is.
Yeah.
I bet.
You know, and he said to me when he was dropping me off, he picked me up in his car, and he said, you know, I love you because we can talk about this stuff and you accept that you may not be right about all of it. And that's not supposed to be a self, you know, praising thing to say. He said it to me, and I feel the same way about him. In other words, when he said to me that Obama was the worst president in the history of the United States, which he said to me, I said, and I immediately shot back with, oh, worse than George W.? I mean, invaded a country when he didn't have to, killed hundreds of thousands of people, dislodged everything, and has made it hell for us, and ISIL has emerged out of this, the worst, you know, maniac since Hitler. How could you not recognize that? And he said, well, he believed in what he did, and the intelligence was bad, which is what everybody says. And I laughed at him, but not in hatred, but just, oh, my God, man, we really do disagree about this, like, seriously, heavily. And, you know, if you there's a movie out right now about the debate between William Buckley and Gore Vidal. Mm. It's in the cinemas, and I'm in the movie. And
really?
Because I did one of the only interviews with William Buckley that was when he first was on television, and Bill Buckley and I got on famously, despite the fact that he wasn't just a right winger, but was the main force that persuaded Ronald Reagan to run for the president, and he was the main man behind Ronald Reagan, in fact, and our arguments were about Ronald Reagan. However, you'll see it in the film, but what I'm just going to say right now is that day, I came in and did the show. I was in London. I flew in for the show. I had the flu. I was very sick, coughing and spluttering and feeling a massive migraine headache. It just felt awful. And when in the hour before the show, which was live at WGBH in Boston, Buckley arrived, sat in the green room with me, looked at me and said, "You're ill." I said, "Yes, Mr. Buckley, I am." He said, "You're really ill. You don't have to do this, you know." I said, "No, you just flew in for this." He said, "No, you don't have to do it." And then he proceeded to show nothing but the most wonderful compassion. And after the show, he put his arm around, he's much taller than me, and he put his arm around me and he said, "You know, I'm really sorry that we had to do this because as much as I enjoyed doing it, you were sick and we shouldn't have done it, really." And then I had a correspondence with Buckley and found out that he was one of the kindest men I've ever met, and truly kind, lovely, lovely man, who showed enormous respect for me despite the fact that I knew almost nothing and was so sweet to me. And we corresponded later, and he even wrote about me in his column in the New York Times as being someone who I totally disagreed with, but I really liked. He said it, not me. And he could have said anything. And I learned something on that day in July of 1968, which was that despite the fact that William F. Buckley Jr. was the exact diametrical opposite, his views, of everything I believed in, that when I actually met him, I liked him enormously. He showed kindness and compassion. He was not self-cherishing. He was interested in my welfare. Hmm. And that's all those years ago, you know. And that was just life that taught me, not a guru, not a Rinpoche, but a right-wing political analyst. Mm. So, you know, it's a long-winded way of putting it, but you do learn from life, you know, and I've met many progressive liberals whose opinions I completely agree with, who I never want to be in the same room again with in this life. So we got to be careful about these angers. Yeah. You know, people are very angry with Donald Trump right now, and I understand that. And on Facebook, as most of you will have noticed, people are just, you know,
I think fear is a more operative word there, as we start to realize, oh my God, he could actually be the president. You're going back to London and I'm going back to Montreal when that happens.
Yes,
we are leaving. Sorry, everybody, on that one.
But I said that about Reagan too in 1980.
No, come on.
I'm gone, you know.
Oh no, but this is way beyond that. I mean,
it is way beyond that, yeah, because obviously Trump has got a lot of anger, to say the least, and is exploiting people's fear and anger in order to get appreciation. But thank goodness it's early, and we have over a year before the election and over 5 months before notable primaries, and probably he'll be faded out. But we said that at the beginning, so maybe we're wrong. But, you know, what Mark Epstein says in this is about our real lives with our wives and children, not with some distant political figure that we see on a screen right. in our house.
Start and, there. We can yeah, start there. Right there. Yeah.
Because, I mean, people say to me all the time, well, God damn it, if you're not angry about the fact that Scott Walker destroyed the unions in Wisconsin, are you angry about that? And I said, yeah, I am angry about that. It's disgusting. The eradication of workers' rights. But I have learned not to, you know, not to hate him and want to kill him.
Well, here's the what we, of course, Maharaji Neem Karoli Baba told us in India after he excoriated somebody for screwing up in the kitchen or doing something really off the wall, like selling the food to make money nobody knew about, and whatever he was doing was just off the wall. And he said, and he screamed at him and threw him out. And we were like, you said not to be angry. And he said, you can be angry, just never throw anyone out of your heart. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that's the key to all of this. I want to turn quickly to this. This is, I guess you would have to term this another practical way that I like to, and I know we like to, Dave, offer everybody out, our little community out there, just a way to deal with all of what we're talking about. And it brings up an expression that was really, I'm pretty sure, I can't say it was coined by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, but certainly comes from his tradition. And he did mention it a lot. And here, one of his disciples that's most well known is Pema Chodron. And this is what she says. So I can explain, or she can explain, what the gap is. And it relates to meditation, and then it relates to life. The space, so in terms of meditation, the space between out-breaths is sometimes called the gap. It points towards some gap in the internal chatter, some experience of spaciousness. It may take quite a long time for the beginning meditator to have an experience of that gap or space, and that's okay. That's why the other part of our meditation instruction is to label any thoughts we have as thinking and just let go of them and come back to the out-breath. That instruction encourages us to interrupt the constant barrage of talking to ourselves. And even if we do that only once, there is already some kind of gap which underlies remembering to come back to the sense of out-breath going out. We may not be aware of it as gap, quote-unquote, but it is already there as the basis of the process of remembering to label thoughts, thinking, and come home, way back home, to the present moment. So that concept of gap is, and Dave and I talk about practice and basic mindfulness practice. I think that this is such an extraordinarily important point to cultivate. And in Trungpa's, his own words, when a gap or space occurs in our experience of mind, when there is a sudden glimpse of awareness, openness, absence of self, here's what happens. A suspicion arises. Suppose I find that there is no solid me. That possibility scares me. I don't want to get into that. That abstract paranoia, this discomfort that something may be wrong, is the source of karmic chain reactions. It is the fear of ultimate confusion and despair. The fear of the absence of the self, of the egoless state, is a constant threat to us. This is like the key to everything to me, right? Yes. Suppose it's true. What then? I'm afraid to look. We don't want to look at ourselves. We want to maintain some solidity. But the only material available with which to work is space, the absence of ego. So we try to solidify or freeze that experience of space. Ignorance, in this case, is not stupidity, but it's a kind of stubbornness. Suddenly we are bewildered by the discovery of selflessness and do not want to accept it. We want to hold on to something. I mean, and that gap, everybody has had that experience one way or the other. It doesn't even have to be in a meditation process. It can be sitting out looking at a lake. I was just at a river today with my dogs, walking them, and a bunch of geese were just, I don't know, they all, at least a dozen of them, were not more than 30 feet out from the rocks, just from, and they were just hanging there. And we just had this ineffable moment of just hanging, all of us, in that one moment. And I want to bring in something really interesting. When Trungpa talks about how you have that moment, you have that gap, and you immediately get into this fear state because, oh my God, if I'm not something solid, holy shit, I'm going to disappear. I'm dead, right? And I was working on a lecture, a talk of Ram Dass's that I'm actually going to be doing a podcast after this. And he talked about having that gap. And in his case, he was talking about a mystical experience. To me, the same. Whatever that moment of complete spaciousness through a mystical experience, through whatever, it upsets the apple cart. It upsets the security that we have of separateness. We push away what he calls our heritage of that spaciousness. We get attached to our desire systems, our separateness. We get afraid of losing our separateness. And out of that comes greed, lust, anxiety. Exactly what Trungpa said here.
Right. Right.
It's the source of karmic chain reactions that finding no solid me, right? And reacting,
you know,
to the, yeah.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
It's funny because yesterday, you know, right now is the 10th anniversary of the Katrina catastrophe, really, that happened in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of stuff on television about it, which some of which has been devastating and interesting. But yesterday, former President Bush went to New Orleans, which everybody thought, what? Come on. You know, because he was so heavily criticized. And he went there, and the video I saw of him was in a school with mainly African-American children. And he was sitting with them, and he was clearly incredibly happy to be with them. And they were happy to be with him. He was chatting with them, and really clearly rather a sweet moment, you know. And I'm looking at it, and I just could not hate him. And it felt good. It felt really good. Because maybe he did a lot of damage. He certainly did. But there's something there. He's a human being just like me and all of you. And when I saw him with those school kids, and he was so natural with them and so clearly so thrilled to be with them. He's got no political axe to grind. I mean, come on. You know, and so I felt some love to him and felt, okay, he's trying. And who am I to judge? God knows I don't know all the facts. I don't know whether he failed so badly. I don't know who failed so badly with Katrina. It's so easy to blame. But I'm glad that I was able to look at that image and just not feel, you know, I can just imagine on Facebook what's going on about that image. Oh, yeah, God, oh, I'm just trying to, you know, make up for a nightmarish, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that may well be true, but I didn't feel that. And I'm glad I didn't feel it. And we all know the old story about Ram Dass putting President Bush on his puja table, along with the great saints of the last 2,000 years, and explaining that, you know, he did not hate Mr. Bush, but felt great pity or compassion for a difficult and maybe even lousy incarnation. That's transcendent thinking. That's why we love these men and women, is because they teach us to go there. You know, I mean, we talked to Gelug Rinpoche a couple of weeks ago, Raghu and I, on the podcast, and can you imagine how horrible it was to be evicted by the Chinese and murdered, and nuns being killed and monasteries being blown up, and they had to run over the Himalayas to India, and it was a nightmare. Gelug had no anger about it, really, none. He just felt sad for those that had oppressed him.
And
this is why we go there. This is why we go to that Tibetan place.
Well, this is why we highly recommend a daily practice which can enlargen those gaps. It's not the right word, enlargen, but and this is another article from Tsokni Rinpoche, another great teacher that we have with us these days and spends a lot of time in America. As these gaps grow longer and a little less startling, we can begin to rest within them. For a brief second or so, we can have a direct experience of what in the Buddhist tradition is known as essence of mind or nature of mind, a luminous, limitless awareness that is not chopped up into subject and object, self and other, perceiver and perceived. All distinctions between the looker and what was being looked at fall away. And for an instant, we experience complete lack of separation between everything we feel, see, smell, and so on, and the awareness that sees, smells, and feels. Our hearts and minds are completely open, and the spark that is our Buddha nature, or soul, or whatever anybody wants to call that, leaps up into a brilliant flame. And that's what we aspire to here on Mind Rolling, Dave. That's our aspiration. And we may have started out with my own not doing quite well with the anger I had last week, but here we are, ended up into, I think, some pretty good words from our teachers about what it is we can actually do in our lives day to day to actualize our aspirations. And the gap, developing the gap, is certainly a major one. We're way over our time here.
By the way, we are.
Yeah, our sponsors are going to get all over us. and we're developing that, folks, getting some sponsors. That's what the more sponsors we get, we won't harangue as much about our Amazon thing. Although we would probably still go on, Dave, and make these recommendations of really cool things you can get, right, that we find. So it's not all self-serving, self-interest here. We appreciate you folks. Write to us. Tell us what you're interested in. You can, by the way, you may be missing, go to mindpodnetwork.com and you can find us Mind Rolling there. You can also find all of our other friends, Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, Lama Surya Dass, Danny Goldberg, Chris Grasso. Everybody's there. And there's comment sections below the podcast. So feel free to give us your feedback. We love it. Dave?
Yep.
Au revoir, as they say.
Au revoir. De bonne chance.
And bonne chance.